Hey there, you're listening to What the Riff? Join us as we remember the great rock and roll hits from a month between 1965 and 1995. We're going to riff on all things about the bands, the members, and the goings-on during that time. We hope to inspire you to find and download the songs you hear today, whether you're fans who forgot about some of these tracks or maybe never even heard them before. Check out our blog at whattheriff.com or follow us on Facebook at What the Riff. Here's a shout out to our sponsors, the Southeastern Railway Museum in Duluth, Georgia, Stanton Electric, a commercial electrical specialist, and Marbury Creative Group, a brand development agency that helps companies tell it better. So let's turn up the volume and enjoy this episode of What the Riff?
The World Wide Web debuts as a publicly available service on the internet. Uzbekistan, Lithuania, Moldavia, Ukraine, Latvia, and Estonia formally declares its independence from the USSR, and a communist coup happens in the Soviet Union and is crushed by a popular resistance by Boris Yeltsin. This is August 1991, and you're listening to What the Riff. I'm Wayne.
I'm Rob.
I'm John.
And I'm Bruce.
And John brings us classic song and album.
Wow.
All right, you get one guess. Based off of that intro,
Oh, yeah.
Who is singing music?
It's
right
got
now?
Me psyched up, buddy.
Who is bringing you some guitar, hard hitting bass? Who is slamming the sticks down on these drums?
All I see here, John, is a video. And it's a video showing the largest concert ever.
Yes.
And it was in the former Soviet Union. 1.6 million people. And this song and the audience is going freaking nuts.
They lose their freaking mind when this song came on. I mean, it was at this, I guess it's September. Hold on. We don't want to step on Hetfield here.
Wow.
Man, Metallica's Black Album. Obviously, this is Inner Sandman. This is kind of their transition album. And like I said, this album came out in August, and they're on stage in September, and like some of these people who are diehard Metallica fans have just gotten this album over there in Europe, in Russia, in Germany, all this stuff, and they hear Metallica is coming to a concert with Megadeth and all these other bands, and I mean they had to put it in an airfield. And it still was overflowing as far as the eye could see.
Wow.
Well, that's what I was thinking. You said 1.6 million
yes.
people?
Yes. So officially, the number was like, they said like 500,000.
No.
But it passed 500,000 so fast, it's ridiculous. Like,
I just can't imagine how you can, I mean, you said they had to move it to an airfield.
You have to see the video. If you see the video, it is just, you just don't see people. You just see people just pumping their fists, just going nuts, and just waves. They didn't even have room for a mosh pit. It was so huge, and they were just waving back
this
and forth.
This was in Hetfield's heyday. This is when Hetfield had learned to master the crowd. He had learned the stage presence. He had learned when to, like, hit stuff, when to interact with the crowd, and, like, he was in his zone. And when he was on that stage, I mean, listen to this, man.
Wow.
Well, the greatest thing about this song, now this to me, is this is Metallica. This is when most people who did not get into Metallica, when obviously Mustaine left, went and played, did Megadeth and stuff like that. But that was kind of considered their really heavy, heavy metal. This is, they kind of smooth this
attenuated
over.
Attenuated it a
and
little
then
bit.
You hear this change now. They're now back with the tom-toms, and they're just like, okay, it's going to build again. It's going to build.
All right.
I love it.
So this song was originally written about sudden infant death syndrome.
Oh, really?
That was the original writing of this song. Yeah. And Hetfield brings the version they had written of that song to their brand-new producer, Bob Rock, who had produced Bon Jovi. He had produced Dr. Feelgood, all that stuff, and they loved it.
What did you say his name was?
Bob Rock.
Oh, not Bob Ross.
Bob Ross.
Because that would just be awesome.
My God, how amazing would that be? Bob Ross was the producer of this album. My God, a little happy little concert over here.
little bit of Happy Little James Hatfield right here.
This is their happy. This is their happy phase. No, it was Bob Rock, and he said, "You know, it's a little morose. I'll be honest with you. Yeah." So Metallica had this thing about when they were making songs, they were never supposed to criticize each other's work on the song. Like, they had this agreement. They didn't want to be that rock band that broke up because they argued about songs.
Huh.
But Bob Rock had no such agreement. He goes, "This song is depressing as hell. Can you make it a little less about dead babies?" And he was like, "Yeah, I can do that." So went back to the drawing board, rewrote the song a little bit. He's like, "Let's just go with the Sandman aspect."
So the Inner Sandman, obviously, it's a kind of a wives tale or fairy tale. Yeah,
children's rhyme.
And then there was a comic book of Sandman, correct?
Well, that was a Sandman that came out in the early 80s, but that not necessarily related.
Oh, okay.
That is just a classic song. One of my favorites.
I love that. I love the way they kind of fade it out a little bit. But this was Darren Hetfield's transitionary period, right? This is when he decided, "I don't want to be just the guy that screams in the mic all the time. I want to be a guy who can actually sing. I want to be known as an actual singer," right? Mm-hmm. And he considered, you know, it, not like he didn't like Injustice for All, and he didn't like, you know, Ride the Lightning songs. They still play those in the concerts every single time.
Sure.
He just wanted the diversity. He thought, "Hey, listen, I think I have the chops to also sing other stuff." All right, let me introduce this song real fast. I don't know if you listen to the Black Album, but like their intros are so good. This is Sad But True. I had a real hard time picking four songs for this.
Really?
Yeah, the whole album is amazing. Like, I almost put, instead of Sad But True, I almost put Of Wolf and Man, which I think is an amazing song. It's not played on the radio very much. That's a song about being a werewolf running through the... but the way they write it, it sounds like you're running through through the jungle or running through a forest.
Was it in the Twilight movies?
Thank God, no. Okay, this is a song about... basically, he wrote this about people who believe blindly in whatever, in religion, in other people, in whatever, in people who
that
don't.
That is sad but true.
Yeah, so this is a song about your lack of knowledge of a subject and yet your faith in it, right? If you listen to it, that's what he's saying. He's got such a great voice.
That's a very distinctive voice, too. If you've never heard the song, you still know it's Metallica.
I mean, they have the hits with the drum and the guitar playing together.
Yeah, right. They're off track, whatever. I forget what the hell they call it. But yeah,
syncopated.
Exactly.
He actually got the idea from this song from the Anthony Hopkins film Magic from the 70s.
Oh, that was a creepy
movie.
Oh,
I saw that with Anne Margaret.
Yeah.
I went to go see that as a kid. I want to say it was like maybe 78, 79. And supposedly Anne Margaret, you know, you kind of had a dress slip there, and you got to see things that, you know, 14-year-olds like to see with Anne Margaret. So.
Do go on.
But yeah, that was the puppet. And I guess Master of Puppets type thing. But yeah, supposedly it was a puppet that was killing people.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was turned out to be Anthony Hopkins. But then we ended up with who? Chucky.
Oh my God. Yeah, the evolution of those movies is crazy.
Yeah.
Did you guys listen to this album very much when it came out?
I did not.
No, this is
just the hits,
yeah,
really.
Not for me.
This was, I mean, I was more into the Manchester sound, and we'll get to that, too. But, yeah, this is when grunge started getting in there, and this is the tail end of heavy metal.
Yeah, I discovered Metallica probably in, like, 85 or so. So I went back and got Ride the Lightning, and, you know, I basically wore that tape out. And then Justice for All came out, and Master of Puppets and Justice for All came out. And then when this album came out, I was literally standing, when the mall opened, I was standing at the gate for them to pull the gate up. I was like, okay, now I know the release date is today.
It was Tuesdays was their album. It was for some reason. I don't know why.
I don't know, but I knew. I was like, I know this album's coming out today.
And we were talking about this, and earlier before we started this, but albums were pretty much on its way out. There were cassettes and CDs was yeah. the main way if you bought this. And you bought the CD for home and the cassette for on the road. And it was really, it was very rare to have a CD player in your vehicle.
Yeah, they had those ones where you could get the tape and plug the tape in and connect it to your little
Walkman.
Yeah,
I have one of those. You're right. I forgot that.
Those were like the transitionary period before they started putting them in cars.
Lynch, when in 1991, I was 3 years into my career, and we would go out with take clients out, or we would have vendors that would take us out for drinks and dinner and stuff.
Yeah.
My recollection of Metallica, specifically Enter Sandman.
Yeah.
That's the song you wanted to request when you were at the Gold Club.
Oh, really?
It was so long.
So you those, get your money's
those $10 lap dances. Yeah.
Instead of it being, you know, 2.5 minutes,
you're like Pink Floyd the Wall.
Yeah. It's 6 minutes long. But that was what was played. Metallica. You can imagine that type of establishment, you know. It just fit.
Bruce is over here, goes, I've never been to the Gold Club. I don't know what you're talking about.
Man, so here's the thing. People nowadays don't realize that Metallica wasn't listened to by the mainstream.
No, it was not.
In fact, they were shunned by the mainstream. You didn't hear Master Puppets on the radio. Mm-hmm. You didn't hear, I mean, there were probably some college places that
Inner Sandman was the big hit.
Inner Sandman was the first time you could hear
on MTV,
Metallica on regular music.
The video's awesome. I mean, the whole bed getting hit by a semi, are you kidding me?
Well, this is the album that contains the songs that
crossed over.
That were really much more accessible. This is where I really didn't care for Metallica before this album, but it's more melodic, it's more accessible. I mean, the songs are long, but that's okay. This is the real introduction, I think, to the mainstream.
And this song is why I told you how James Hetfield wanted to branch into less screaming. This is the song where he banked that on.
Oh, yeah.
This is the second
release or something of the single?
Second video as well off of the album. So the music video.
Yeah, I remember this song, obviously.
Now, there is no connection between this song and the movie Unforgiven. No.
No connection at all. However,
just they're both. It's a good movie, good song.
That's right.
So, Hetfield based his vocals in this off of Chris Isaak's Wicked Game. That's what he studied, is the way Chris Isaak approached Wicked Game to be able to try to like push the vowels and the longer consonants in this song.
I do want to say one thing. This is like at the time when heavy metal just started fragmenting. And one of it was, I could see how Metallica could have gone to I call it the death metal, where you got the double bass drums and the gravelly voice guy who's just, you know, kind of screaming at things. So, yeah, I can see where this made them international stars. And there were pariahs not too long after this because of Netscape, correct?
Oh, you're talking about the lawsuits and stuff?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they did. They kind of made themselves hated by the public for a little while. Not the diehard Metallica fans, obviously, but like the people who were stealing music and stuff like that.
Oh, the Napster folks.
The Napster.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. All right. So you got in 1983, you got Kill 'Em All. 84, you got Ride the Lightning. 86, you get Master of Puppets. 88, you get Injustice for All, okay? In between 86 and 88, a major event happened, and that was Burton's death. Burton was the bass guitar player. So basically, they were touring Europe. They had just come out with a Master of Puppets not too long ago, and it was doing great. And they were as beloved in Europe as they were in the U.S., and they're touring. They are getting on the tour bus after a concert, and they always would draw straws as to which bunk they were going to sleep in because some of them were way better than the other ones on the tour bus, right?
Okay.
And so they drew the straws to sleep in the bunks, and they climb in to go to sleep as their bus was being driven across, you know, the icy roads.
Yeah.
And the tour bus crashes. And the bus, I mean, it was a real bad crash. Like, they're sound asleep. They wake up being thrown in every direction. So, Hetfield said, I saw the bus lying right on him. Talking about Burton, Cliff Burton. I saw his legs sticking out. I freaked out. The bus driver, I recall, was trying to yank the blanket out from under him to use for other people. I just went, don't effing do that. I already wanted to kill the bus driver. I don't know if he was drunk or if he hit some ice. All I knew was he was driving and Cliff wasn't with us anymore. I mean, it was obvious that it immediately killed Cliff.
Always heard on those buses, you're supposed to sleep with your feet facing forward. Because of, obviously, if you get in a wreck,
you don't want your head to get snapped.
Yeah, your head's not going head first.
Yeah.
They don't do that on planes, though.
So the death of that really hurt Hetfield and Ulrich. Like, they considered breaking Metallica right then.
Really?
Like, they talked about it. It was an actual conversation. And finally, Hetfield said he came to the conclusion that Cliff Burton loved Metallica. He loved the work they had put in, and they were like, "Well, let's just keep going then. You know, we'll know when it's time to end." Apparently, they haven't found that yet because they're still touring. They're still producing albums.
I think that's one of those things where different groups have to make different decisions. You know, like the Beatles always said, you know, if we can't record as John, Paul, George, and Ringo, it's not the Beatles, you know? And
it isn't, that's right.
Oh, and you got The Who, even with the death of two members, prime members, are still going on.
And we've covered a number of bands that today are ghost bands because there's nobody from the original group. It's just the name has been passed down. So there's this whole spectrum out there in the rock world of how people handle that.
All right, so back to this song. Bob Rock basically said, up until this point, when they recorded Hetfield's song for the album, they did this thing called doubling. You heard that term before?
Where they record, like, two different tracks, the same voice, two different tracks.
Yeah, and they would layer them, right?
While sound.
And he's like, basically, you know, it has a unique sound to it, but it also kind of kills any range you can do when you double it like that, because if you stray too much during the recording of it, then it messes with the song itself. And this is the first time Hetfield basically strayed away from that doubling when they recorded it.
Well, that's a beautiful song.
Mm-hmm. It is
really
beautiful.
Is.
Yeah, it's, right?
And classic. I really, really do like this album, even though I never bought the album, but I've had a couple of the songs.
Once again, we all had careers. We were all out of college. And
not we all.
I mean, I wasn't married yet.
I was a freshman in high school.
Bruce and Rob were married at the time.
No, I wasn't married yet, but it was during my early career days.
I had kids in 1991.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Awesome.
The twins. Another classic song here. Another intro that's just so cool.
It is cool. And this song, this is Nothing Else Matters. This is, I think, their fourth release off of that album. Third or fourth, I can't remember now.
So what matters to them?
Nothing else matters.
Then what?
All right, so... All right,
Abbott Costello.
Yeah.
Basically, Hetfield originally wrote this song about a girl he had dated, right? And then eventually broken up with. And so he was like, kind of heartbroken, and he was basically like, you know, if you don't have love, if you don't have connection with other humans, nothing else matters, right? That was the original incarnation of this song. That's what inspired him to write this song. He says in an interview in about 2010, he goes, I cannot tell you the name of the girl I wrote this song about. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you what I was feeling about her. He's like, you know, the truth of the matter is, he's like, I've come to the realization that the true meaning of Nothing Else Matters is if we don't have fans, if Metallica doesn't have fans, then nothing else we do matters. Because it doesn't matter what songs we produce if nobody listens to them. It doesn't matter what concerts we throw if nobody shows up. So that's what he's like. If I had to tell you what Nothing Else Matters, if I wrote it today, that's what I would write it about. I would write it about our fans and the people who have gotten us to where we are today, which is kind of deep. I mean, I think for you know, a rock guitar guy, right? But he writes deep songs. If you listen to his song,
that's the thing. And I did not realize that until you started bringing these groups, Lynch, that how deep the Metallica lyrics are. I really hadn't paid attention to it, so I appreciate you bringing these.
Well, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer did a song, You Turn Me On, and that was, we talked about that, and I always thought it was dealing with a woman, but it's actually, once again, similar frame of mind of what this song was, is it's actually talking to the audience and saying, you still turn me on.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. So these, you hear from these guys that, I mean, these guys are poets, essentially. They're modern day, you know, versions of poets. I mean, they're bards or whatever you want to call them from way back in the day. But, I mean, and Hetfield is just a classic. He's just classic, a poet. And so he writes these things from the heart. I mean, he feels them all. Even all the way back to Kill 'Em All. When Ulrich first put out an ad and Hetfield answered the ad, Ulrich saw in Hetfield the poet that would eventually become this amazing writer. He said, you know, I got to have this guy immediately.
Maybe he answered it in poetry.
Oh, my. I wish.
And he probably came in and says, hey, that's my theme song for life, Kill 'Em All.
He's like, okay, I'm not getting on this guy's bad side if that's his theme song for life. So, I mean, everybody up until Miley Cyrus and Elton John releasing a version of this song 2021. You got people like Pat Boone, who did an album called I'm Feeling a Little Metal or something like that.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, that
he covered a bunch of Metallica songs.
Well, Metallica, to your earlier point, they're one of those bands, like if you see Rick Beato and he does like greatest guitar intros of all time, and he'll say, I can't tell you who this is and the song because they'll block me, but
oh, yeah,
if I play it, and I'm going to play it a little differently, but you'll know what it is. And so he'll kind of he appreciates them from a artist standpoint, but he's like, they are way too strict, kind of like we've heard Pink Floyd is.
Yeah, Eagles.
Yeah, so if you hear this podcast,
Pink Floyd.
Yeah, you may not. This may be a short-lived podcast.
Yeah, I'll tell you this. Metallica is a little less strict about it now.
Are they?
They've got music videos that have hit, their personal music videos on YouTube have hit over 1 billion hits.
Yeah.
I mean, they're making bank. They don't have to work another day in their lives.
Well, we don't. Once again, this is not for you to try to listen to the song for us. Go out and download these albums.
Yes.
Yeah, you're desperate if you're listening to this song over us talking about it.
Yeah. Go to their concerts. You need to be hitting these things up. We're promoting these people.
Pay them money.
Exactly.
That's right.
Absolutely. You should pay them money. I must have bought this album 3 different times.
And Hatfield, if you're out there, come on, join What the Riff. You know?
Oh, I'd love it. Now, I've seen Metallica live 3 times. I saw them once back in the 90s. I saw them once in the 2000s at the BlizzCon, and then Heather and I went and saw them here in Atlanta
about 2 years ago.
Yeah, 2021 or so.
Yeah.
You didn't see them standing in an airfield in the former Soviet Union by any chance.
Oddly enough, in September of 1991, I was doing schoolwork in high school, so I was not able to attend to that amazing concert.
They had a big, like, 40-year tour, I think is what it was. Last year, my sister-in-law, April, she flew by herself out to the West Coast for this concert.
Well, they're based in San Fran. They've always been San Fran, like, called home, though I imagine they barely home at all.
Yeah. Well, that was amazing. Well, thanks for bringing this album.
Thanks for letting me, guys. My game plan is to break the rules and bring a third album called Ride the Lightning.
We'll see what we can do. Yeah. All right, thanks, Lynch. We appreciate that. Now we're going to our entertainment track brought to us by the Southeastern Railway Museum in Duluth, Georgia.
And film of August 1991. It was a film called Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man. It's a biker film with Mickey Rourke and Don Johnson, and this is one of the songs on it. And this song is the Kentucky Headhunters. It's Let's Work Together, and you probably remember hearing this. I think it was one of those songs that from the 60s, but it even dates further back than that. But yeah, if you get a chance, go out and see the Kentucky Headhunters. It's going to be a fun concert. You won't know any of the songs, but you're going to have a great time.
It's like hip-hop bluegrass.
Exactly. So
little rockabilly.
There was a cartoon out called Rover Dangerfield. And it was an animated comedy film with the comedian Rodney Dangerfield.
I was a big Rodney Dangerfield fan of the 80s, man. I loved his work.
All right, some sequels that came out. Beastmaster 2. It was based off the 1982 film, The Beastmaster. Mark Singer reprises his role.
Never saw it.
I saw the first one. I didn't see the second one.
Oh, my God. You guys are missing class. I mean, they're terrible.
But the first Beastmaster, if you were alive in the 80s, it was all over TV. It was like a TBS would run it every other show.
Like, basically, every Saturday and Sunday, they would run that thing at some point. You could just sit down and turn the TV, and eventually you'd find it.
Another movie nobody watched was Return to the Blue Lagoon, and I didn't see that. And we talked about Chucky, Child's Play 3, that slasher film with Chucky was in that.
Those are creepy. I hate to admit it, but they are kind of scary.
Showdown in Little Tokyo is a buddy cop film with Dolph Lundgren and Brandon Lee. And I don't remember that. Yeah. Obviously, I remember The Crow with him in it. Dead Again was a romantic thriller with Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson. I think they were married at the time, but at each other's throat. And there was a pretty interesting movie by the Coen brothers called Bart and Fink. I don't know if you guys saw that with John Turturro. It's set in 1941.
It's another weird movie, but if you like those guys, it's very entertaining.
Then we had Double Impact with Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yeah. That was some of your entertainment from August 1991.
All right, and we're going to kick off our staff picks with you, Wayne.
Okay. Once again, guys, I come with you with that Madchester psychedelic sound. But this time I'm out of London with Blur again. I did one of their songs previously. This song is called She's So High.
How high is she?
I'm kind of surprised we haven't done an album by these guys.
You know, I think they were bigger after 95, so... but, you know, a lot of people... This is back then was the big time of getting high was with Ecstasy. One of the... writers of the song said he never thought this song was about drugs. It was more that the person is in love with someone that he can't have.
Yeah, out of his league.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I mean, it's a very dreamy type song. I mean, it goes with that.
Yeah, they got that echoey voiceover going.
And this is one of the songs I remember from my visit from Manchester. It was July 4th of 1991. And we went to a place called the Hacienda. And I think I told you guys before about it. I had to get patted down because there was a stabbing there a few weeks beforehand. But earlier that day, we were looking for a place to eat and drink. And it was July 4th, and here are us Yanks just walking around. And there was a place having a July 4th celebration. And I'm just going, hey, yeah, man, let's go. And the rest of the group goes, hey, man, I think this is more of an ironic party, and I don't think we're going to be accepted real well.
Hey, Wayne.
Yeah, remember,
hey,
it's
Wayne.
Independence from the country that you're in.
That's right.
Wayne, it's only treason if you lose.
Yeah. Well, this song actually reached number 48 in the UK singles chart, and it was the first single by Blur that came out.
I've got to say, this is a different song than I thought it was when I saw the
There's
name.
Another song, She's So High.
She's So High Above Me.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's a different song.
We'll have to put that one on the database.
That would be a good one.
That's a fun song, too. Yeah. I actually, when I first saw it, I went, I think that's that song. And it turned out, no, it wasn't. But yeah, this is that ethereal.
That other one was used on Dumb and Dumber.
Oh,
was it really?
Yeah, remember?
I was thinking we may have covered it.
It might have been an entertainment track or something.
You would have seen it on the database. It probably would have come up, but anyway.
Well, this is back when you released things as singles. So there's actually cassette tapes that were singles. CDs were single.
Yeah.
Yeah, the A and B side.
This was actually put out as a 45, and it showed a naked woman riding a hippopotamus. And all I can guess is she got it as a present for Christmas.
Yes. Only a hippopotamus will do.
The first time I remember this song was on MTV's 120 Minutes. If you remember that, that's when it usually came on around midnight or 11 o'clock Central Time is where I was at. But yeah, you could actually, I recorded it on tape because I wanted to.
On VHS.
I mean, they had all these groups from Europe, different, I guess you'd call your, you know, I guess college hits, your modern, you know, rock music than it was then. What we, you know, at this time, I mean, my goodness, we had top hits of August 91. Listen to this. Okay. Bryan Adams, Everything I Do It For You. Rhythm Syndicate, PASSION, Passion. I have no idea. Amy Grant, Every Heartbeat.
Almost put that one on the staff picks.
Amy Grant's just amazing.
Just to see what the reaction I would get.
I would get a thumbs up for you, my friend.
DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, Summertime.
That's a phenomenal song.
Lenny Kravitz, It Ain't Over Till It's Over.
That's a good one.
Roxette, Fading Like a Flower, Every Time You Leave. And so, yeah, I don't remember a single one of those songs.
You don't remember Roxette?
I remember the group, but I don't remember that song.
It's a good song.
But other Blur songs that we, you know, you might remember, it was called Song 2, and it was the one that goes, woo-hoo.
Oh, yeah.
And the girls and boys, the girl who want boys who want girls, which I guess you can't do that song anymore. Girl, I don't know. Sorry. I'm not too PC.
Really?
That's Blur, news. She's So High.
Yeah, great. Good job. All right, well, I've got a staff pick here.
Rob, what you got?
Name it with the first guitar strum there. This song was written by
John Wayne.
Jonathan Cain.
Oh,
John. What is it now?
Yeah.
Oh, wrong John.
Yep. But that is John Wayne singing. I think he's got one of the coolest voices.
He does.
Yeah.
Very distinct. Yeah.
And he had a great look for the videos, too. I mean, he was just like, that's who you wanted. It's like, I would like to have that as
you
a
like
job.
You like your front man.
So is Jonathan Cain in Bad English?
Yes.
Okay.
So Bad English basically came together out of Journey in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Jonathan Cain and Neil Sean.
Oh, really? Neil Sean was in this, too.
And
okay.
Dean Castronovo on drums.
Oh.
So, I mean, those are heavy hitters
from
Journey.
How could you not have a hit with it?
Yeah, really.
I kind of agree with that. Then you got Ricky Phillips on bass, and, of course, John Waite, lead vocals.
And we talked about Jonathan Cain and John Waite being in the Babies before they joined Journey.
Yes. Right.
This was basically a super group of the Babies and Journey.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. We've covered John Waite on What the Riff as a solo artist. We've covered him as a member of the Babies and a member of this group, Bad English. Bruce, you did, you covered them in episode 228.
Right, their first album.
Yeah, their first album. That was their debut album, and it was just called,
I believe it was just Bad English. I believe
it was
eponymous.
Bad English. Yep, and that had, do you remember the big hit on that one?
Oh, they had a number of hits off of it. But
number one was When I See You Smile.
Yes, yes.
And that was in November of 89. Of course, this is August of 1991. Sadly, they only had two albums, that one and this one. And this one is called Backlash.
I think a lot of those supergroups, they get so many talented people together, and they're pulling different directions. I mean, go back to Cream. I mean, I think they had like three albums and a couple of live albums before they disbanded.
Yeah. Well, that was definitely the case with Bad English because they were torn between doing our own thing and doing the what's going to be pop.
Were they torn between two lovers and feeling like a fool?
Yes.
Listen to Neil Sean on here. Neil's just tearing it up with the guitar.
Yeah, he was upset a lot about when Journey had Steve Perry and they wanted to do a lot of the ballads. And he was more the rocker coming from the Santana.
Right.
He was with Santana before that. So, yeah, he wanted to let go.
Yeah, I can't imagine the egos. The producers, you know, they knew what they were in for. It's like, I got an idea. It's going to probably last about 2 years, but let's do this.
I don't have an idea, but don't call me Shirley.
Okay, this might be the dad joke episode. Keep that up, Wayne.
Wait, have we done a non-dad joke episode yet?
It is our core competence.
I did do the head first joke earlier. You know.
I love the sound. I love the way that they adapted to the changing demands of music too. Like,
yes.
Like this you could hear. I mean, this is kind of like a pre-Wonderwall, the new English bands that were coming out. Like,
yeah.
I mean, these guys were like ahead of the time. They were ahead of that 1996 swap to that new rock sound.
Yeah, they definitely they knew. I mean, that's the thing about a supergroup. They know how to make the music. They know how to do that. All right, well, now we're going to go to Bruce for our next staff pick.
And, yes, indeed.
What do you have for us, Bruce?
So, back in the day, if you were listening to 96 Rock, this is a song that you definitely heard, even though it's difficult to find today. This is a group called RTZ, and it is off of their debut album, Return to Zero.
Oh, now I understand. I thought it was a drug label, RTZ.
No.
If you take RTZ, you need to contact your physician.
Ask your doctor if RTZ is right for you.
So RTZ is kind of a geek thing because it's programming.
Yes, it is.
So this group was formed by guitarist Barry Goudreau and vocalist Brad Delp.
Boston.
Where have you heard those names before?
Just a band out of Boston.
That's right. Both Brad Delp and Barry Goudreau were in Boston when they formed. And this is a song called Face the Music. Do you recognize it now?
I do now, yeah. Now okay. It might have been since freaking mid-90s since I heard this song.
It's definitely timestamp. Early 90s, late 80s.
So Goudreau had left Boston a long time ago, and he formed a group called Orion the Hunter, which was one in 84. And the way that Boston put out albums, people were always desperate for that sound, right? So when Goudreau and Delp formed the group, they brought in Brian Mays, who was a keyboardist with Orion the Hunter. And then additional members were Tim Archibald on bass, and David Chepinel on drums. And this song went to number 49 on the U.S. pop charts.
Really?
And number 5 on the rock charts.
Man, I can hear I can see the credits rolling on a mid-1990s rom-com right now. I mean, this was like this was a sound they went for closing out movies back then.
Well, they did have they got some success out of this. In fact, because of the success of RTZ, Brad Delp left Boston. And that then when they did the album Walk On, Delp was not the primary vocalist on that, although he returned to the band a couple of years later because RTZ didn't have the staying power.
It has a similar feel to the one we just heard from Bad English a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this was the time where in the rock areas you had a lot of heavily produced type of music. And I think especially compared to Boston, because Tom Scholz was so, you know, hands-on with the production.
Right.
This has a much more commercial sound to it.
So you got to think, this is right as Nirvana is coming out.
Yep.
Big. This is Soundgarden has been big-ish, but now they're about to hit hard. You got Alice in Chains that is taking over the charts. You got the new grunge phase. It doesn't last very long, but when it hit, it was huge.
Oh, it was a steamroller. It was a semi hit in the bed. It was coming down your throat.
Yeah.
And these are the months that music changed.
Yeah.
If you can kind of go through August, September of 91, suddenly, you know, it was a flick of a switch and boom. It was all grunge.
The months the music changed instead of the day the music died.
Yeah. I was thinking the same
thing.
Well,
it's the same thing with the Beatles when they came out. I mean, you had disco come through with groups like the Bee Gees.
Very good. So that's RTZ.
All right, yeah.
I feel the hate coming off you when you say the word Bee Gees.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that, Bruce.
Oh, well. Mr. Rock and Roll over there, you're doing Metallica. Now you got another heavy metal group, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Seal, obviously, a very metal heavy group.
I really did dig Seal's sound.
This was a great song.
I still listen to this song all the time. Let me try to say his name, his real name.
Oh. Say it.
Seal Henry Olusegun Olumide Adeola Samuel. Born 19th of February, 1963. And he's an English singer. And I think he's got a phenomenal voice. I had to bring Seal. In 91, this song hit so hard. He wrote this song about the crazy events of 88, 89, specifically the fall of the Berlin Wall.
It is really hard to overestimate what a day that was when you saw the Berlin Wall fall.
It was massive. And you hear that? I see you, my friend. I touch your face again. That's two people looking at each other from the other side of the wall who have been apart for their whole lives, and they see each other, and, like, the world changes for them.
Well, we got a piece of the Berlin Wall down here in our nearby town called Suwanee. They imported a piece, and they've, you know, got a piece of the World Trade Center, too. But it's part of an art now. I mean, I assume that wall went all over the world. I mean, there's concrete blocks of that wall in museums and everywhere.
So this song was not an instant hit, but it rose rapidly through the charts. It got up there, never hit number one, but it was a good hit, especially in the UK. Especially in the US, UK, Australia, Canada, it did well. Sold 20 million records worldwide. This album.
I can believe it.
It's got such a haunting quality to it.
What I like about Seal is that you can hear his accent in his voice, and it's so smooth.
Mm-hmm.
I love the way he incorporates it into his music. He just absolutely leans into it, and it's just a beautiful sound. I mean, he might be the only person to ever use the word fractal in a song lyric. I don't know if I've ever heard the word fractal in a song lyric before.
And music is the poorer for it.
Hey, absolutely. More mathematical terms should be included in music.
That's right. A little more chaos,
right, here
theory,
we go. We're
please.
Get, in a sky full of people, only some want to fly. Isn't that crazy? So he's saying, the world is up to you. Your options are open. And yet you choose to walk. You could fly, but you choose to walk.
That's pretty deep.
It's pretty deep.
Hey, at that time, I was learning to fly. Sorry. More dad jokes.
Did you guys listen to this at all?
Oh, yeah. This thing was huge. Once again, this is sort of that Manchester sound a little bit. You know, it's the ethereal, dreamlike music kind of in the background. It's not as psychedelic.
But you could see this being played in a rave, in a dance hall, you know, for 20 minutes straight.
This is when you had dance. You could do a 12-inch dance mix to this song. Yeah, there's that out there.
Yeah, I like Seal. I like this song. There's a couple of others that I liked a little better.
Yeah. I liked that from the Batman soundtracks, Kiss from a Rose.
Yeah. Oh, Kiss from a Rose is amazing. I love that song. Alanis Morissette covered this in the mid-2000s, the Crazy, and released a music video on it and everything.
Really?
And it actually did pretty well. And then also it helped spike his version back up to the top.
Nice. Right.
This is just one of my favorite Seal songs.
Yeah. Well, it's good. I think it was appropriate. That makes it a good episode. Thanks for bringing that one to finish up our staff picks there, Lynch.
A little contrast to Metallica, right?
Yeah, definitely. Now we're going to go on to it's either an instrumental or a laugh track. And I believe we have an instrumental here.
Yeah, it's from a group called Timbuk3 called Sunshine. And they actually had a regular song with lyrics, but this was their instrumental. It was off the album Big Shot in the Dark.
I remember them.
Yeah, they had the song, you know, My Future's,
the future's So Bright, yep. I Gotta Wear Shades.
Exactly. So, but also in August of 91, other things that happened in music, some albums that came out. Robin Hitchcock and the Egyptians had Perspex Island. Metallica, we talked about that, had the album Metallica, or you want to call it the Black Album. Spin Doctors had Pocketful of Kryptonite.
Oh my God, and one of my favorite albums.
That would have been a good album, but we've already picked two songs of Staff Picks on there, so there's a couple of songs left. We did Blur. Donna Summer had an album out. I don't know if that was still disco or
Donna
not.
Donna Summer was putting out albums in August of 91?
Yeah,
my God.
Exactly. Talk about Bad English with Backlash. Toad the Red Sprocket. I don't know. Did we do the album Fear?
We did Dulcinea.
Oh, okay, yeah. We did that album a while
back. Rob did that.
Fear's a good one, too, though.
Bob Seger had The Fire Inside. Neil Diamond had Lovescape, so I assume... And then
Donna Summer and Neil Diamond, staying power.
There you go.
Then we had the album that would kick those guys to the curb. 10. Pearl Jam.
Yeah. 10. That was a phenomenal album. Yeah. I love Pearl Jam.
Some of the other happenings of August of 91 in music. Funk singer Rick James, if you remember him, he was arrested on sexual torture charges.
Dang.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Yeah, so.
She must have been a kinky girl.
She was a very kinky girl. The kind you do not take home to mama.
And Paul Simon did a concert in the park in Central Park. It was a free concert, and it was broadcast live on HBO. But I remember the Simon and Garfunkel version of that.
It was earlier on, like 82 or so.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, that's your music of August 91, and we're What the Riff. I'm Wayne.
I'm Rob.
I'm John.
And I'm Bruce.
See you guys next time. Hope you guys enjoy it.
Thanks for listening to What the Riff? We hope you enjoyed the songs we had on tap today. Please tell your friends about us. Check us out at whattheriff.com and follow us on Facebook. Special thanks to our sponsors, the Southeastern Railway Museum, Stanton Electric, and Marbury Creative Group. That's all for this week. See you next week on What the Riff?